And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Sarah Coffey to the program today. Sarah is a native of Memphis who currently calls Western Pennsylvania home. We'll be discussing her debut, a thriller called While We Were Burning, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Sarah, how long ago did the first inklings of While We Were Burning come to you?
I would say the book came to me during the summer of 2020, with what was happening with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And basically, I just had a sinking suspicion at the time that we weren't going to see justice done in those cases. So that kind of, got a fire under me to write a book about seeking justice, essentially.
And so there is a character named Breonna spelled differently,
yes.
But is that inspired by?
Yes, 100%, yeah.
Now, the book opens with boiling emotions from a woman named Lizzie, and she's married to a man named David. What's her state of mind in that opening?
I want Elizabeth to basically come off as delusional, actually. I often tell readers that you're supposed to feel like Elizabeth thinks she's the main character, but she's actually in the wrong book. So you're opening with her very focused about her marriage and these awful things and not realizing there's something bigger coming for her.
Yeah, it's almost like someone else in the book is playing chess and she doesn't even know there's a game.
Exactly, yeah.
St. Augustine is quoted as writing, "Resentment is like drinking a poison and waiting for the other person to die." And she's harboring a lot of resentment in her.
Yeah, basically, I'm trying to answer this without spoiling the book.
No, it is. It's difficult. You've written a very intricate thriller here, and we've got to dance around everything.
Yes, I will say I do agree with that quote, and it depends on how readers feel about the end of the book, but I would say how I feel about the end of the book, I think it matches that quote exactly, that, yeah, you're seeking revenge, it's going to come back on both parties.
In turn, she's called Liz, Lizzie, and Elizabeth. Is there any significance in the different names that she goes by during the course of the book?
I wouldn't say there's too much significance. I was just thinking, nicknames and just showing how close she is to each character, really. So who calls her which, and to kind of notice that as well. And there's also something that I can't really spoil. There's another nickname I will say that David uses for her, and it's kind of a big deal when he stops using it, but I can't say too much about it. So, but yeah, the nicknames are significant.
How did she and David get to Memphis? They're not originally from here.
Yeah, there is about possibly up to 20,000 words that were just scrapped, that it was just there's too much to put in this book, but they have a background. I believe in the book I said they came for David's job, but I didn't go too much into it, but there is a backstory there about how they chose Memphis and how they ended up in Memphis.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that backstory since you wanted to keep everything tight and lean in the book. Let's hear some of that.
You kind of get hints of Elizabeth and David's more progressive leanings as people. So I would say that was factored into it too. They're we want to go to a city that's diverse. But of course, the joke of it is, right? They come to a city that's diverse, but they choose to live in a wider part of the city. So that is part of the thinking behind that.
And they met at college. Doesn't seem to be a relationship that has a lot of healthy boundaries.
Yeah, no. I would say, I think from David's point of view, at least earlier on, he had healthy boundaries with Elizabeth. This is also more background that doesn't make it into the book. Whereas Elizabeth, hints at, does say she was basically obsessed with him from day one, right? Whereas David just thought, this is a nice girl I met at a party. So different levels of intensity there. But yeah, Elizabeth is probably the more, I'll say toxic one, definitely, in their relationship.
And he's a very handsome man, and a lot of women take notice of that.
Yes, that's part of it, too.
In fact, it's a novel full of good-looking people. Do you think it's essential for commercial fiction to have all these kind of pretty people that could be played by pretty people in the movies?
That was not part of my thinking. I wanted it to be from the reader's point of view, because I had people ask me early on, why is Elizabeth so obsessed with David? They're like, I don't get it. I don't like him. I will admit, I wrote him to be likable, but people do not like David very much. But you can fall back on, well, he's very attractive, right? So you can see why she became obsessed very early on. Others also see that. Meanwhile, for Breonna's level of attraction, I kind of wanted that to be something more playing in the characters' heads about how attractive she is. Because, I think in the book when they first meet, Elizabeth is actually concerned about how attractive Breonna is. Of course, David also notices it too. And it's kind of playing into almost this othering of her, right, based on her beauty. Because I mentioned she's also, dark-skinned as well. So they're very much very much othering it, almost fetishizing it when it comes to Breonna's beauty in the book.
And David, we don't get a chance to be too sympathetic toward him because we see him filtered through these other two characters' points of view. And especially Elizabeth, she does not have the most charitable view of her husband.
Yeah, exactly. When you first meet everyone, yeah. I will also say I've had readers pick up on that too, where they're like, you know, David is just, again, unlikable to readers, but I will say again, he was not written to be unlikable. But people are like, this do not care for him right off the bat, usually.
What was your intent?
My intent was to have someone, he's supposed to be charming, and it's just not landing with people. But that's like the idea is, you get why she likes him. He's attractive, he's charming, and you're like, oh, that's why, you know, she's so, you know, obsessed with this man. But the readers are just like, I don't trust him. I don't like him from, as soon as they meet him, they're like, no, thank you. So, and I will say, I also tried to fix that in revisions, and it didn't work. It didn't take. So.
Do we just have too big a history of movies with handsome white male characters who come off as the bad guy in the movies?
I will say people who read thrillers, I think that's part of it too, right? Especially domestic thrillers where, you know, all the drama is centered on the home. And I think people just know from reading domestic thrillers, like, you know, do not trust the husband, right? He did something. You don't know what it is, but you know he did something bad. That's the idea. So I think they also come in like, do not trust this man. No matter if he's charming, he's evil. There's something wrong.
The characters are flawed, and we are flawed too. Everyone on Earth is flawed, but boy, these people are working with a lot.
Yeah, that was intentional. Like, I've been going around, you know, saying, I was like, I love unlikable female characters. I really do. I mean, that's more of like a feminist stance. I just feel like in fiction, especially genre fiction, there's this expectation that, you know, your female lead needs to be, you know, likable in quotes for people to relate to her and root for her. And I'm like, as a thriller writer, I'm like, I'm more interested in, you know, having a good time and seeing what they're up to. And that does not need to be morally correct, right? Like, I don't need it to be correct to enjoy what's happening with these characters. So I like giving female characters kind of the room to be just messy people on the page. So.
Are you doing that because it's interesting, or do you want to make a wider point about what we expect of each other in the world?
I would say both. Like, first and foremost, like, I just enjoy the messiness of it. So that's the first point. But yeah, I think the wider point is just, as I was saying earlier with genre fiction for women, I was like, I feel like we just need more portrayals of just women, especially just being, you know, messy, imperfect, making decisions that we do not agree with at all, and getting kind of their viewpoint and into their head about it, and not expecting women to be just like these perfect moral creatures in fiction.
Do you think that is a misogynistic take to expect this ultimate moral rectitude from women, or is it just misguided?
I wouldn't say misogynistic or misguided. This might be the fault of, maybe it is misogynistic. I hadn't thought about it before. Maybe it is misogynistic. I'm realizing as I said it, maybe it actually is. I was going to say just a lot of publishing, a lot of books for just, you know, people come in reading it and they just expect to like the female character. And they're like, oh, you know, she's not making decisions I would make. She's not doing things I want her to do. You know, there are even reviews, especially for thriller writers, you know, readers are like, you know, oh, did not finish this like at 20% of the book because she's making decisions I personally, you know, don't agree with. And I'm like, that's to me an uncharitable way to experience fiction, right? So I'm like hoping my book in some small way can get readers kind of out of that more, because I'm like, you should just be following the characters as they are and not necessarily passing, I'll say, real world moral judgment. Of course, they're bad people, but not being as concerned with real world moral judgment as you're enjoying a story, you know.
In this, expecting rectitude from your characters, or at least sympathizing them in their actions, do you think that's just like a larger symptom of our inability to be sympathetic and empathetic toward our fellow people in society?
Ooh, that's a good question. I want to say yes, right? Because I think we have this problem in the real world too, outside of fiction, where someone is imperfect or does things we don't agree with. And we're like, well, I would have never done that, right? That wouldn't have happened to me because I would have done X, Y, Z. I wouldn't have been there. You know, all these things, people try to rationalize with characters. I think, unfortunately, there is a connection there for fiction too.
It's Halloween as we kick off the book, and Elizabeth and David are hosting a Halloween party at their Harbortown home. Why did you pick Harbortown as the white enclave they would make themselves a part of?
I picked Harbortown because, let me not get in trouble, but basically, I mean, it's not controversial to say that Harbortown is Memphis's white enclave. I feel comfortable saying that. That is like, you know, if you want to enjoy the city of Memphis, but not necessarily enjoy its diversity, I think you're safe in Harbortown, last time I checked demographic wise. So I thought that was a good place to position them.
Because, I mean, East Memphis would also be a possibility there as well.
Oh, yes. And I believe this comes up in the book as well. Elizabeth says, you know, she doesn't want to be in East Memphis. right? When I think of Cordova, that area, because she's like, oh, that's very stuffy and doesn't have, like, you know, this artsy feel. Sorry to Cordova to say this out loud, but basically it doesn't have the reputation that I would say Harbortown does, where it's like, oh, you know, it's a little walkable part of Memphis. We have the river here. All the houses are very cute, you know, all these things that I think Harbortown is just hipper is basically what I'm getting at.
Saw in a previous Q&A that they sent out with the book that they referred to it as a suburb. And while it tries to act like a suburb, it's very much part of town.
Yeah. The feel of Harbortown is very much suburb, very much gated community, but it's not gated. You know, it is just part of the city. Yeah.
Well, its gate is water, I guess. So they have this Halloween party going on, and she's complaining about kind of her surface relationships with people in the neighborhood. She thinks there's not a whole lot of authentic behavior there. There's a lot of lying and people presenting fronts that they aren't truly themselves there. So she has not integrated herself in the community very well.
Part of that is Elizabeth, I think as I mentioned earlier, being very delusional, right? Not self-aware, because she's saying, oh, everyone's fake except for me. But we see her being very fake at that party, right? She's not honest about her intentions with people, or how she talks to Patricia, like, you're calling everyone else fake and you're so real. But clearly that's not true from, like, the first chapter, so.
She can see the failings in others, but she only kind of views herself as a victim.
Exactly what I was going for, where it's like, okay, so there's something about this woman's worldview that is slanted, right? She is unable to kind of see things for what they are, although she feels very strongly that she is seeing things exactly as they are. So I thought, you know, that's kind of fun for that character to have that just obvious tension going on with them.
In the early 90s, there was a rock band called Jellyfish, and they had a song called Glutton of Sympathy. And I think that really applies to her.
Elizabeth is like, you know, every bad thing that happens to her, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to anyone in the world. And, you know, that's just a fact, right? We're not going to compare. She's like, if it happened to me and it's bad, like, I'm having the worst day. This is the worst day anyone's ever had. Just very much that energy.
Now, she's been invited by her kind of work friend and neighbor, Patricia, to go on an early morning walk for exercise, because these people are just dedicated to preserving their facades. And that walk doesn't go as she thought it would go.
Yeah. I don't know how much I can say without spoiling, but yes, this does not go.
Well, I think in the first two chapters, we have to be able to say something.
Yeah, we're safe. Okay. Yeah. So it doesn't go as, you know, Elizabeth thought it was going to go, because, you know, they never go on that walk, first off. Like, and it's because she finds, you know, Patricia dead, which is just a major, of course, shock for her. That's really what kickstarts the book, like discovering Patricia dead. And also Elizabeth thinking kind of, you know, just in her heart that it was murder when everyone else does think it was a suicide.
Yeah, she's not an adherent of Occam's razor.
No.
The most convoluted solution is the most obvious to her. Now, in chapter 3, we meet Brianna Thompson, and she is grieving so severely that she and her partner, Charles, can't even say the name of the person that was taken from them.
Mm-hmm. Oof. Yeah, that was, sorry. When I think about all the scenes of grief, they were all very hard to write, that one especially. The opening of Brianna's grieving, she's arguably grieving throughout the entire book. So part of that was just showing, you know, how in grief they were. They couldn't say the person's name who died. Of course, the other part was just a book structure, right? Because I wanted readers to be like, who died? You know, what happened? What's the, you know, and then hopefully keep turning the page to figure out what happened there. But it was also a commentary on, like, grief.
So I try not to read any press materials before I read a book. I want to be tabula rasa as possible.
Yeah.
And I just had briefly heard kind of like a log line for the book. And then I looked at the inside flap, and it gives away some information that doesn't come until well into the book.
Yes.
So what were the discussions like that with the marketing team?
So I will say I push back on that copy a lot. But for me, I was like, maybe I'm ultimately too close to it. But I'm like, I feel like this reveals a lot. Others who have read it, they say, you know, that didn't really tell them anything. They didn't feel like it, you know, spoiled the book. So I was like, okay. So at the end, I was like, I trust the marketing team because I don't have a degree in marketing, right? So like, just putting it in their hands and like hoping it works for the readers too.
But I'm the kind of person, when I see a movie trailer, I try to stop watching it because I think they just give away so much in those.
Yeah. Again, I think the other thing, too, is as my agent actually told me, we were talking about the copy as well. And she basically said something to the effect of people who read thrillers, you know, they're going in already trying to figure out all these twists, you know. And she was like, you have some good twists in there that no one's going to be able to figure out. So you're fine. She was like, you know, they figure out, you know, I think it's maybe 4 or 5 total. If they figure out the first two, that's OK. Right. She's like, that's not going to even ruin the book. So it's like, you know, assume the reader is already trying to figure it out as soon as they pick it up. And then, you know, the bigger twists are big enough that, you know, they're still satisfied by the end of it.
Now, in your bio, it says you want to humanize Black women and have them space on the page so they can breathe. What does that look like to you? What exemplifies that?
Yeah. So for me, I will say first and foremost, that looks like Brianna's characterization. Like, she is not by any means a perfect person for various reasons. But I think it is important to have that characterization. So it's like, you know, she does not respond, I will say, the way we expect in society Black women and women of color to respond when they are aggrieved. I'll put it that way so I don't spoil it. But she does not respond correctly. And I was like, I think that's important. Like, you know, there are just different aspects to people. And I don't know how to say this without it sounds so simple, but I'm like, you know, Black women are people, right? It sounds so obvious, but I have to say it. It's like, you know, so we're going to have very like human responses to things. And I think it's important to show that versus kind of getting into what I said earlier about women, you know, in books and how they're portrayed, that Black women also have these different dimensions to them as well.
It's just barely mentioned at the beginning, but I think it means so much. She mentions she'd only been to 2 funerals beforehand, her mother and her grandmother. And that indicates that she has kind of been cut off from a support system as well.
Yes.
That when this terrible thing happens to her and her partner, that there's not going to be anyone there for her.
I think I can say it without spoiling it. The only person that's really there for her, I will say, is Pastor Freeman in the chapter where she's grieving. So that's kind of where, you know, she has that connection. But she also mentioned she's that much of a churchgoer, right? So this is someone who, you know, helped her through her mom's passing and the grandma's passing. But that's not necessarily the place she goes to for support outside of him. So.
And the answers he has are not the ones she's looking for.
No. I feel comfortable saying, I think Pastor Freeman is probably the only good moral person in the entire book.
Yeah. Well, I will say my character that I would like to spend time with in the book was Vera.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Vera.
We don't get to see much of her, but she just comes across as a genuine person that, you know, doesn't seem to have an ulterior motive.
Yeah, I feel like Vera always says exactly what she's thinking. So she's very trustworthy. Yeah, there's no sense of doublespeak. Like, she just says it, even if it's, you know, sometimes problematic to say, but she's very honest with her feelings.
Because that is a major theme and mechanic of the book, is things that are left unsaid, things that are hidden. And there's people all over covering up their true intentions.
Yes. Very, very much a running theme in the book.
We have point of view chapters from both Elizabeth and Brianna's points of view, but Elizabeth is written in first person and Brianna in a close third person. Why did you take that approach to the two characters?
Yeah, so for Elizabeth's POV, this goes back to, I think, something I said earlier, where I mentioned how Elizabeth thinks she's the main character, right? So I was like, so of course, someone who thinks you're the main character, it's first person. It's all about me and my point of view. Whereas Brianna, close third, is because this is someone who's interacting with the world in a more genuine way, I'll say. Cares more about others, kind of thinks through things. I was like, so of course, her POV is more like, you know, me, but also what's going on around me, right? Like, what am I able to kind of see around me? So I think kind of trying to show her empathy through her POV versus Elizabeth, who's like, it's all about me right now. And you're in my book. It's my story.
There are many crimes of all different levels of whether it's legal or not during the course of the book. And some of them are committed through negligence and assumptions of privilege. And others are intentional and vengeful. But the effects are all still the same. The ruination of people's lives.
Yeah. I thought you were about to start talking about Brianna's shoplifting scene, but I was going to say, you know, there are some lesser crimes in this book too. I was like, yeah, that's probably the smallest crime committed in the book is probably shoplifting. So
there are levels of intent there.
Yes.
But effects all the same.
Yeah. And I will say, even in the Brianna shoplifting scene, you know, the reader's supposed to get this is someone, you know, what's that movie called? Falling Down? Is it from the 80s?
Oh, the Joel Schumacher with Michael.
Yes. Yeah. So that's basically for the reader to kind of feel like, okay, she's spiraling, you know, to have a Black woman kind of brazenly shoplifting. It's like, oh, she's wanting something to happen. She's trying to force a confrontation. Like, you know, why would she do this? And to get reader thinking, okay, she's not doing okay right now. To get that sense.
As we hear in other pieces of media, you know, she wants to feel something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And she's going to feel it one way or another.
Yes.
Now, there's no shortage of white American experience portrayals in media and in literature in America. But what was it like for you to write across race in writing Elizabeth?
I will say, because I was mostly trying to make a point, it wasn't too difficult to me. A lot of it was very like meta commentary about, you know, the domestic thriller space, which is also a very white space, right? There are not too many leads in domestic thrillers, psychological thrillers who aren't white women. So it was like, you know, a combination of like, I'm making a statement and not that difficult to write because I've read a lot of thrillers that featured said white women. So kind of taking those experiences too.
The way you write her character and you see the evolution of her thinking during that, super well done. But she never has to confront her whiteness, really, unless it's in context of Brianna. And so that seemed like a very powerful statement there, too, in that.
Yeah. And Elizabeth very much thinks she is a good moral person. I'll put it that way. So she also thinks she is very progressive, just votes the right way, all these things. And of course, never considers, you know, how her whiteness affects really anything or privilege. I think maybe get one moment in the book where she asks, you know, kind of tongue in cheek to her husband, right? Like, oh, are we bad? You know, are we not good people? But even then, it's like, how sincere is that question, right? She clearly thinks she's a good person. So
David himself, you know, there's not a whole lot of kind of outward discussions of race during the course of the book, but you see it the way people act, behave, the way they speak and think about things. And that he does recognize that his status as a person who does real estate development in Memphis, gentrification coming up, and he seems to be troubled by it, but not so troubled that he's not taking the money.
Exactly. Again, I would say David and Elizabeth in a real way deserve each other. I'll put it that way. They're kind of two sides of the same coin because, yeah, another character who thinks he's progressive, thinks he's a good guy, and like you just said, is not really considering that he is helping gentrify a city that, you know, he just moved to on top of it. He's not even from here and he's helping to gentrify it. So, yeah.
But maybe that's one of the reasons people don't care for him so much.
Exactly. Another reason people dislike David.
Now, I thought your approach in including texting and social media posts was really well done. What's your process in including these and making them part of the story, but not alienating people in the process?
Yeah, so my purpose of including those to begin with was just, I don't know how to put this and sound sane, but I wanted the book to feel real. I would often say, like, I want the book to feel like it's alive, just so people can feel like, oh, this is a real thing that's happening. They'd be super engaged with it, you know? So hopefully hitting that part of their brain that is like, oh, this is real. It's not just fiction. I can kind of imagine this whole thing playing out, right? So I thought that was cool to include social media posts and all that. I also just kind of wanted to include the Nextdoor stuff because at that time when I was writing, I was seeing posts on Nextdoor and stuff. And one I saw actually from Harbortown and Harbortown area, because you can search, you know, locations when, as long as you're in the city. Fun fact about Nextdoor. Basically, I saw a post where someone said, like, oh, you know, there's this black teenager walking through my neighborhood and like, who is this? And then thankfully, in this case, her neighbors came, you know, and they said, like, oh, no, that's so-and-so's child. And of course, in the post, it was a black woman saying, yeah, that's my son. You know, we live here. We're new. You know, and I was like, how concerning is that? How wild is that, that you have this person just posting on Nextdoor, like, you know, whose black kid is this? And should I call the police? Should I be worried? And I'm like, not considering, right, that like you have, maybe you have a black neighbor. Just just a side note about social media and Nextdoor. But yeah, thinking of that and putting in the story, that's where that came from.
I wrote a silly review of a Christmas album a few years ago, and it was the point of view of two guys who lived in a neighborhood and said, oh, someone down the street put out a Christmas record. And the guy says, you don't spend a lot of time on Nextdoor, do you? And he goes, nah, I get enough racism down at the shop.
That's great.
So when you first came up with this idea around the time of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor killings, how has the idea for the book changed over up to the point where you gave over those final edits?
Ooh, it has changed quite a bit. I think, I'll put it this way, I always knew I wanted it to be a revenge thriller, so that part never changed. It was more about the shape that revenge took and how far it was going to go. Like, is there going to be murder? I had a version that was just like, it's basically just ruining someone's life. But no, you know, nothing else. Like, you know, not a lot of crimes there. You know, I was thinking like just how deep do I want this to go and, you know, what's going to be symbolic about it. So there was quite a bit of change. Even when I finished, I would say a good draft of it, I still had to revise for a year to keep working on it. So when you said that, I was just having a flashback to a Word doc. Like I said, like 20,000 words just cut. Nothing's aren't there anymore. Different outlines too. So
do you think there's anything interesting in those 20,000 words that can be repurposed in the future for something else?
I think so. I have told people, it's like, if I ever need to do like a, you know, David and Elizabeth prequel for some reason, I could actually probably write it. I have a lot of information about things that, you know, get like small mentions in the book. And it's funny, I've had readers ask about them and I'm just like, I know the answer. It's not going to be in the book officially, but I can just tell you things like that.
I've seen other writers, especially ones that write series, they'll have like a 1.5 or a 2.5 short story that comes out in between, kind of bridges. Yeah. Two parts of a series, and you could have like a 0.5.
Exactly. I could do the same for Brianna as well. Yeah, just if you want more background for whatever reason, I got it.
You mentioned before we were talking that you're currently working on another project. Are you able to talk about that, or do you feel like you're going to crush the bunny if you do?
I think the only thing I've been approved to say, let me find the right sentence. I have been approved for one sentence only. I think it goes something like this. A woman who seems to have a perfect life starts to think that someone or something is controlling her every thought and move.
Okay, so we have paranoia is a big theme in your stories here.
Yes.
So what is it about paranoia that interests you so?
Writing a thriller, basically what I do is just sit for a moment and think about all the things that scare me personally. So that's how I come up with a lot of my ideas and stuff. I'm just like, what's the scariest thing I could imagine, right? You know, of course, while we're burning, it's someone plotting revenge, you know, thriller, like happening to me or something that is horrifying. You're like, whoa, someone's been, you know, thinking about this for so long, like something I did, you know. For the second book, yeah, it's paranoia. It's like, you know, I feel, I don't think anyone is controlling my every thought or move, you know, but maybe. So just working from those fears and putting them down on the page. Yeah.
Well, it seems like Google's listening to us whenever we look on our phone and our search results.
Exactly.
Wait a second, why did I get this ad? So just imagine how you could manipulate search results to kind of push people to certain actions.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, you just assume, you know, not to sound too paranoid, but you assume your choices, you know, and the way you think, you know, are your own. But like you just said, you know, you have your devices. You also may have like, you know, an Echo Dot, Alexa in your home, things just listening and, you know, basically changing things so you like them better, like the ads you're served, things like that. If you mention, oh, my TV's broken, suddenly, you know, you have an Amazon ad. It's like, yeah, it's like your world is being affected by these things. So
as the old saying goes, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
Exactly. Agree.
And also with Elizabeth, I thought her character was interesting because when she finds her kind of friend, Patricia, hanging outside, she disassociates.
Yes.
And so we know that not only does she have probably a personality disorder, but she has acute mental illness as well.
Yes. Yeah, that was part of it for me too. I'm trying to put this in a way that is not problematic. But yeah, because I care deeply about representing, you know, mental illness in books, things like that too, but also trying to make it entertaining to the reader, you know, as someone who has had, you know, like panic attacks, moments like that, where you just kind of like, you're not where you should be, you know, grounded, basically. I was like, well, how do you do that in a way that's still interesting to read, right? Which is not the greatest way to put it, but I'm like, just a point of consideration when we're writing these things. The same thing goes for grief. The same thing goes for depression and anxiety, which I also touch on. Like, how do you make it, you know, just interesting to the reader? Because a lot of it, and this is true, but depressing to say, is a lot of it is very samey. You know, when you're experiencing it, it just feels like the same thing over and over again. But yeah, for the reader, it can't read that way. So
I once had a panic attack. I was at a literary journal release party. And I didn't know anyone there.
Yeah.
And I texted a friend. I said, freaking out, man. And he goes, are you breathing? I went, oh, good idea. I'll start breathing.
Oh, my gosh. I think my worst panic attack to date, I was on a plane. It was really embarrassing because, you know, they have to call a doctor and everyone's just looking at you like, oh, is this person about to die? And it's just like, oh, you're just having a panic attack. You're fine. And I was like, oh, that's such an embarrassing feeling.
The book officially comes out today, the day that we're speaking, but you've had early readers. What have responses been like from early readers?
Yeah, that's a rule. I generally don't, you know, look at reviews, good or bad. I've seen so many authors talk about that, just tanking their mental health for days after, like just, you know, looking at stuff like that. So the only reviews I've seen are people who specifically tag me in them. And I will say historically, when they tag me, they're good reviews. I haven't had a bad tag yet. I've heard that happens too. And also hearing from readers who just, you know, will DM me on social media to talk about it. I got to speak to a book club in advance. That was a lot of fun too. Just like a, you know, a small local one. So things like that. But generally, you know, what I've been hearing is, you know, they like it. They love the twist. Depending on how you feel, some people feel it's a happy ending. That one's more controversial. As I said earlier, though, everyone hates David. I've yet to meet anyone else in any capacity who likes David as a character or is willing to defend him at all.
talking about a David who everyone loves. He got blurred by David Joy, and he kind of sticks out like a sore thumb amongst all the other blurbs on the back. But it's because, you know, here's this guy that writes grit lit amongst poor white folks in the hills of North Carolina. And so it was great that y'all two can kind of find that commonality where the works do cross over.
For this book, I feel very lucky and grateful in that I got a bunch of blurbs. I actually got so many blurbs that they could not fit them all on the back of the book, or even on like a lot of the press stuff. There's like, maybe 15 to 20 people who took their time out to blurb this book, which is amazing. But that is also too many blurbs, actually, to do anything with in publishing. But I'm like, it's great. But yeah, I'm eventually going to make a post online where I just thank everyone. But I am very grateful that people took time out to read it.
So are you now part of the blurb cycle? Have you gotten your arcs to start blurbing?
I haven't gotten any arcs or blurb yet. And I suspect that's because my agent knows that I'm currently drafting. Because when we were, you know, doing the blurb process for the first book, we get people's agents being like, hey, they can't look at this right now because they're working on something. So I'm assuming I have that buffer until my deadline. And then I suspect I will get requests after that.
When you're drafting, do you feel free just to keep writing, or are you a reviser as you goer?
Ooh, I am a reviser as I go. I try to get to a point where it's clean as I can get first draft. So there's nothing that says like, oh, I'll write this part later. It's all already written. I'm more comfortable there. You know, revising is also important, but I'm like, I like a clean first draft. So I don't have to be like, well, what was I intending to put here? You know, I don't have anything that goes here.
Or are these weird little TKs there?
No, all the TKs. Yeah, I can't do that.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your debut novel with us. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Coffey is the author of the novel While We Were Burning, which is published by G.P. Putnam Sons. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.